The only way to be defeated is through our resistance in the region and internationally,
okay.
in a resistance camp led by Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, all of the resistant forces of our region.
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me. Khalid Barakat, spokesperson, Masar Badel Movement out of Vancouver. Zafar Bangash, director, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto. And as always, it's a pleasure having you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the group right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ribbiyyun kathir. فَمَا وَهَنُوا لِمَا أَصَابَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ وَمَا ضَعُفُوا وَمَا اسْتَكَانُوا وَاللَّهُ يُحِبُّ الصَّابِرِينَ وَمَا كَانَ قَوْلَهُمْ إِلَّا أَنْ قَالُوا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا وَثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَنَا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا إسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord. So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair. And make firm our feet, and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world, and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia's president says that he ordered his forces to avoid bloodshed during the recent armed mutiny, adding that enemies wanted Russians to kill each other. Sudan's paramilitary forces announced a unilateral truce during Eid al-Adha, as the army confirms the capture of a police base by the RSF. Also in the headlines, Muslims attending the Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia mark Arafah, the most important day of the annual pilgrimage. Thanks for joining us. The Russian president has spoken for the first time since an armed mutiny was aborted in his country. He says that enemies wanted Russians to turn their guns on each other.
It was precisely this outcome, a fratricide, that the enemies of Russia wanted. The neo-Nazis in Kyiv and their Western patrons and also sub-nationalist traitors. They wanted Russian soldiers to kill each other so that servicemen and civilians would die, so that in the end Russia would lose and our society would split, choking bloody civil strife.
Putin said that he had given an order to avoid bloodshed, adding that the revolt left Russia united. He called the rebellion a revenge for Ukraine's failed counteroffensive. The Russian leader said even if the Wagner private military group had not stood down, the revolt would have been suppressed anyway. He warned that any blackmail is doomed to fail. The Russian leader stressed that organizers of the rebellion would be brought to justice. Putin also met with Russian security officials, thanking them for their work during the revolt. The rebellion was launched by the Wagner Group after a long-running dispute with the Defense Ministry over the war in Ukraine. It was called off in less than 24 hours, following a Belarusian brokered agreement between Wagner and Moscow. Our correspondent Johnny Miller had joined us with the latest on the situation in Russia and its impacts on the front lines of the Ukraine war.
I think there's an idea in, and now also, of course, you have these allegations that Western intelligence agencies have been involved as well. But there's an idea, of course, in Western media and politicians, they're all salivating at the idea of a Russian civil war. The reality is that any division in Russian society isn't between people who are against Vladimir Putin, he's very popular, isn't against the Kremlin or against the war. The real division, or if there is a division, is between people who think that the war should be ended more firmly and Russia could take a harder line on Ukraine, or whether they should keep this more softly approach on ending the war. But you also have the absurd situation now in that you have a British former general who is now saying that Wagner are now only 100 kilometers north of Kiev. Wagner now, many of their troops moving to Belarus. So we'll have to wait and see the long-term effect of this, but the reality is on the ground that Ukrainian counteroffensive is failing, and both sides are accusing each other of potentially blowing up the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. So the dangers of this war escalating are very, very real, and the attempt or the threat to Russian society dividing is certainly not happening at the moment.
New figures from Britain's National Health Service show the cost of living crisis in the country has taken a heavy toll on the mental health of children and youngsters. According to the data, a record 1.4 million under 18s sought help for mental problems in 2022. That was the second year in a row the referrals beat the 1 million mark. The authorities say the mental issues among school-aged children have undergone an explosion since the year 2019, partially due to the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, the Young Minds charity, which has analyzed and reported the NHS data, says that its own numbers show young people are facing a unique combination of challenges, mostly due to worries about money. The UK and many other Western countries face record inflation figures, mainly triggered by the Ukraine war and sanctions on Russia, which led to major disruptions to global energy and food supplies. On to the war in Sudan, where the paramilitary rapid support forces have announced a unilateral truce during the Muslim holiday of the Eid al-Adha. RSF Commander General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo said the truce will be effective on Tuesday and Wednesday. The announcement came as the army confirmed that the RSF had taken a well-equipped police base in the capital, Khartoum. There are also reports of fighting spreading for the first time to Blue Nile State near Ethiopia. Fighting has increased since a series of ceasefire deals failed to stick. The power struggle that broke out between the army and the RSF in mid-April has killed thousands of people. It has also caused a humanitarian crisis and displaced 2.5 million people. Muslim pilgrims are converging on Mount Arafat in Saudi Arabia as part of the annual Hajj ritual. Pilgrims are marking the day of Arafat, one of the high points of the Hajj pilgrimage. They're expected to use the day for prayers, as Muslims believe that God, the Almighty, forgives all their sins on this day. The hill of Arafat is also known as Jabal al-Rahmah. That means Mountain of Mercy, where the Prophet Muhammad delivered his final sermon, calling for equality and unity among Muslims. More than 2.5 million pilgrims are performing the Hajj this year after Saudi Arabia removed all COVID-related restrictions for the first time since 2019. Hakime Sarayaberia, academic and political analyst, joins us. Welcome to the program. You know, this year it's got to be electrifying to be there because obviously restrictions were lifted because of COVID. And this day, if you can explain to us what its significance is, because it's one of the most important days of this journey that the pilgrims are making.
Thank you for having me. We could say that the day of Arafat is the high point of the Hajj pilgrimage, which in itself has a lot of significance in terms of the social and individual benefits that can be received by the Muslim community at large. You know, the different Muslim communities that are attending the Hajj ceremony is like different rivers that are getting together at the Hajj pilgrimage and creating the sea of the Muslim Ummah. It is we see that at the day of Arafat, which is the high point of the Hajj pilgrimage, which is a day of spirituality, which is a day of remembering God together. Basically, that togetherness, I think, is important that you see that the Muslim Ummah is taking part in these rituals, which has a lot of symbolism in it, that we are there to reject all kinds of idols that may, create an obstacle in the way of worshiping God on earth and creating the community that God Almighty wants us to create here on earth, which is a community free of racism, a community free of all different kinds of, different kinds of oppressions that could be brought on human community. So this is basically the high point of the Hajj pilgrimage, that is the significance of this day.
When you take a look at how this has evolved throughout the years, do you think that just the journey itself, based on what it signifies and based on the meanings that it has gained more popularity in terms of the views that's being held from non-Muslims? Because we know that there's a lot of interest in the message that Islam gives and portrays.
Yes, that is true. That when you look at the ayahs of the Quran that talk about the Hajj, you see that Allah Almighty says that the Hajj has been there for the whole of humanity. It has been there before Islam, and Islam brought more significance to the issue of Hajj and this pilgrimage and gave it life, basically. So it has a message for the whole of humanity, and that is why you see that different human communities around the world that are interested in justice and are interested in achieving equality and a just way of living on this earth are attracted to the Hajj pilgrimage. And you see that it has brought about transformation in many different personalities. That one major personality that comes to mind is Malcolm X, how he was transformed by the Hajj ceremony, that he found the light of Islam. Basically, that he saw it in person, that how Islam had removed all different kinds of demarcations between human beings that are there, that have no justification. For example, the race demarcation, the class demarcation, the many different things that are there. The different languages, the different cultures. When you go there in Hajj, you see that all those lines are basically blurred together, and you see one single, one unified human being that actually wants to be, to live the way that God wants human beings to live. So it has a lot of significance for the whole of humanity, and that is why in some of the words of Ayatollah Khamenei in about the Hajj in this year, we saw that he mentioned the significance of Hajj for the coming world order, that in the new world order, we could actually get a lot of lessons from this pilgrimage, that how the human world should be organized. It should get beyond all those different, hierarchical ways of looking at humanity, that some human beings are superior to others and some human beings have the right to basically exert their own will and interests on everyone else. In the next world order, in the world order that is to come, we should, as human beings, and especially Muslims, should take the agency and take the initiative and take lessons from the Hajj pilgrim, actually work toward a more just world order in the coming years.
And I do have to ask you, given the fact that the restrictions were in place because of COVID, whether you've had personal experiences in terms of people from Iran that have gone there, because there's lots of excitement, obviously, for people who could not attend because of the restrictions. Now they were able to do that because there was an air of excitement behind this year's Hajj when it came to Iranians.
Of course, it is, and from what I was looking regarding this issue online, I saw that there is a different a more jubilant environment over there, and of course, this recent relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia made the environment a bit better for Iranian pilgrims as well. But I think it is, in general, it is an environment of jubilation that people are once again able to go there free of the restrictions and be able to actually benefit from the very things that Hajj has to offer for us all.
Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Hakimeh Sarayabiria there, academic and political analyst. Thank you for your thoughts. Well, as Muslims around the world are preparing to celebrate Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, many Afghans are struggling to afford basic necessities amid an economic crisis and Western sanctions. Our correspondent Rahmatullah Baghban has more from Kabul.
Eid al-Adha is one of the most important festivals in Islam, commemorating the willingness of Prophet Ibrahim to sacrifice his son for God. Traditionally, Afghan Muslims mark the occasion by slaughtering an animal, such as a sheep, goat, or cow, and sharing the meat with their family, friends, and the poor. But for many Afghans, this year's celebration is overshadowed by economic hardships and sanctions.
This has been my job for almost 20 years. I bring cows, sheep, and other livestock here. This aid, the demands are very low compared to previous ones. People come to check the prices, but they can't afford to buy. I have brought 30 sheep, but none is sold so far. I am counting on 8-day sales.
The impact of the economic crisis and sanctions on the Eid al-Adha preparation is also evident in Kabul bazaars and on the streets. People said that sales were low in most Kabul markets, as families were not able to afford Eid necessities.
As you see, this Eid, people are running out of money. They've been grappling with poverty and unemployment. It goes without saying that sales are low. In the past years, people have been taking great preparations for Eid. They used to buy new clothes, gifts, sweets and nuts. But now they have opted to buy cheap alternatives or skip some rituals.
Despite the challenges, some Afghans are trying to keep their spirits up and celebrate Eid al-Adha with dignity and hope. They say they still find joy in their Islamic and national traditions.
Although Afghan people, especially women and girls, are going through tough situations, we want to seek joy in Eid and prepare for a celebration. We want to be happy and keep our spirits up. We came here for Eid shopping, and it shows we are not losing hope.
Afghans are calling on the international community to lift the sanctions and resume relief aid that has been suspended or reduced since the Taliban takeover. As Afghans prepare for Eid al-Adha celebration, they are hoping for peace and prosperity in their war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The economy remains at the center of friction between China and the West. The Chinese Prime Minister has taken a swipe at the U.S. and the EU for their economic policies towards his country.
In the West, some people are hyping up what is called cutting reliance and de-risking. These two concepts are a false proposition because the development of economic globalization is such that the world economy has become a common entity in which you and I are both intermingled.
These remarks come as the European Commission outlined its approach toward Beijing last week. The approach revolves around de-risking and aims to reduce dependence on China in critical technologies. The U.S. has also adopted a similar stance, with President Joe Biden taking a hard line on Beijing. He has barred American companies from exporting high-tech semiconductors to China. Despite Western measures, the Chinese economy keeps growing. The Chinese government says the country is on track in reaching its annual economic growth target of around 5%. And that does it for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names, In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we said that the Islamic Revolution and its unmatched leader, Imam Khomeini, drew the attention of the world thinkers from the very beginning. For a couple of episodes, we have dwelt upon the views of the French thinker, Michel Foucault, on Imam Khomeini. Today, we will continue the discussion. Michel Foucault believed that not only religion is not the opium of masses, but also it is the spirit of the spiritless world. In view of this, he maintained that religion is the engine which unites various classes in society and brings their forces together towards a common goal. Today we are going to explain Foucault's opinion on the concept of power in the Islamic Revolution. Stay with us, please. French thinker Michel Foucault is of the opinion that power is not limited to a specific group, class, or person. He believes that power has a network structure, which is spread in the whole society like the nervous system. Power is a kind of software and is not necessarily wielded through violent means. Thus, a speech, a book, a tape, a piece of voice or video in the modern form of the medium can be a source of power. The French thinker says that power has been spread in every individual, and if they get united, they will make a power which cannot be confronted with any army or power. He analyzes the Iranian people's confrontation with the armed-to-the-teeth royal army in this framework. Foucault explains why the Shah regime failed to resist against the people despite the high military and economic power. He says that although the Shah's army possessed the most advanced weapons and equipment in the region and enjoyed the consultation of over 40,000 American advisors, it was defeated by the people who sacrificed all they had in the way of their leader. As for the economic power too, the regime enjoyed exorbitant oil revenues which would fill the coffers of the royal family. Foucault maintains that the Iranian society was not that poor to cause the people to topple the ruling system. Of course, this is not true, and poverty can be considered one of the factors for the nationwide uprising of the Iranian people. Michel Foucault fails to understand the depth of the Iranian people's belief in and love of their religious leaders, especially the bravest and most uncompromising of them, Imam Khomeini. Moreover, he has not realized the fact that, except the top brass, the main fiber of the army was formed of popular forces and officers who defied the commands of their top commanders in shooting and killing their compatriots and Muslim brothers. French thinker Michel Foucault relates what he had seen in one of the suburbs of Tehran during the Islamic Revolution. In a very unsafe place around Tehran, my friends made the preparations for my visit with a few top officers who were among the opponents of the Shah's regime. They told me that the more violent the unrest becomes, the regime would be forced to resort to the military units that are neither ready for the job nor have they the motive for it. Moreover, they would understand that they are not facing the international communism, but the ordinary people, the businessmen, employees, or jobless people who are like their brothers or themselves. These people can be forced to shoot only once, but not the second time. 8 months ago, they were forced in Tabriz to change the garrisons. In Tehran too, although some units have come from other provinces, they were forced to change them. Foucault makes it clear that he has heard that some of the military forces had targeted their commanders or committed suicide the day after shooting the ordinary people. Michel Foucault continues on the Islamic Revolution. What astonished me in Iran is that there is no battle among different elements. What makes all these beautiful and important is that there is only a single confrontation. The confrontation of all people with the power which threatens the people with weapons and police. No need to go very far. This point can be understood instantly. On one side, there is the entire will of the people, and on the other side, there are the machine guns. Foucault compares the Islamic Revolution of Iran with other revolutions and says, Iran's events, in fact, are not found in China, or in Vietnam, or in Cuba. It is a huge wave without a military tool, without a party in the front. It is the first paradoxical phenomenon, and the reason for the hastiness of these events is that people have struggled for 10 months against a regime which is one of the most armed regimes in the world, and that with bare hands, without resorting to armed struggle. They have petrified the army bravely and decisively. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Israeli regime and its aggressive apologists have plumbed new depths in their ongoing weaponization of anti-Semitism by trying to deplatform the legendary musician Roger Waters. The fabricated accusations against Waters were initiated by the Zionist entity itself following one of his concerts in Berlin. But the acquiescent corporate media and the docile political class just accepted the line from Tel Aviv without bothering to check its veracity. We'll be discussing the implications and possible repercussions of this latest Zionist scam after Latifa Abu Chakra's report into the way in which this manufactured outrage picked up a head of steam.
The Zionist lobby campaign against Pink Floyd's singer Roger Waters has intensified. This time, it started directly with the official Twitter account for the Zionist entity. The lie began when Israel tweeted the words, "Good morning to everyone but Roger Waters," who spent the evening in Berlin, yes, Berlin, desecrating the memory of Anne Frank and the 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust. But of course, quite the opposite was true. Waters had sought to honour the memory of Anne Frank, amongst others in his show. But it turns out that was exactly what the Zionists really took issue with. Danny Dannon, chairman of Netanyahu's Likud party, then tweeted, "At a Berlin concert, Roger Waters compared Anne Frank to Shireen Abu Akleh. Waters seeks to compare Israel to the Nazis. He is disgracefully one of the biggest Jew haters of our time." Adding to this high-powered pylon came Deborah Lipstadt, recently appointed US Special Envoy for Combating Anti-Semitism. She tweeted that she supported an EU official's condemnation of Waters and that he was responsible for despicable Holocaust distortion. This naked attempt to decontextualize the content of his life show and whip up a social media storm then began to reveal its aim, deplatforming the Pink Floyd figure from future shows. The insufferable lobby group, the Board of Deputies, which has a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy, then entered the fray. The statement by the Board of Deputies lamented that it was very concerning that someone with a history of such comments will shortly be appearing at venues around the country. The aim was to deplatform Waters from his UK shows. The instrument in Parliament would be MP Christian Wakeford, a former member of the Conservative Friends of Israel and now a member of the Labour Friends of Israel. He called for Waters to not be platformed in Manchester. The ever-servile Keir Starmer scuttled into the picture to give his backing to the absurd claims from the Board of Deputies. The Labour Party leader sent a letter to the Board of Deputies denouncing Waters as clearly espousing anti-Semitic views and supporting his deplatforming. Waters, for his part, responded to Wakeford from the stage in the London O2 Arena, stating, "You are making things up because you've been told by your masters in the Foreign Office in Tel Aviv." Has the lobby bitten off more than it can chew this time?
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeym University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Jackie Walker. Jackie's a political activist and a writer. She was also vice chair of Momentum when it was founded. Jackie's been a teacher and anti-racism trainer and co-wrote and performed her one-woman show called The Lynching. And she joined us earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, were you surprised by the intensification of the campaign against Roger Waters?
Well, it happened at a particular moment, but no. I mean, this is the process. Of course, they've got rid of Jeremy Corbyn several years ago, then they go on to other targets, and they will not let up. This is what many of us have been saying for a long time. They will not let up until every possible vestige of support for the Palestinians is removed from the public sphere. The objection they seem to have had to Roger Waters was that he mentioned Shireen Abu Akleh. You can't mention journalists who are Palestinian who are shot in the head by the IDF, because that would be somehow anti-Semitic when you put it in the context of other people who've been murdered by the state. And, of course, the key person there is Anne Frank. Now, this is a nonsense, an absolute nonsense, and it's been everyone sees it's nonsense, and that's why it's a sort of, it looks like a bit of an overreach. But, no, I'm not surprised by the intensification. They will do this as much as they can until we fight back.
Well, I asked Jackie how she thought this campaign against Roger Waters differs from the accusations thrown at less well-known people.
See, I don't think it's that much different. I think the scale of it is different, and I think Roger is handling it in a different way. But it's the same old, isn't it? It's kind of conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, and it's all smearing, and it's actually just lying as well. It's the same old stuff, really. You'd think they'd come up with something new, but I suppose they can't.
David, I mean, this feeding frenzy against Roger Waters was actually started by the Zionist entity's official Twitter account. I mean, what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us something which we've been saying for a long time, that the Zionist movement is a cohesive and centrally directed and centrally coordinated movement. They have their own WhatsApp groups, they have channels of communication. Yes, they have different tendencies within the Zionist movement, but this stuff is directed from Tel Aviv and from their ministries there and their covert operatives, and it goes, it's fed out through all the different organizations who with whom they collaborate, and that means practically all of the Zionist organizations, whether they're on the left or on the right, they coordinate and they're directed from Tel Aviv. This is not it's not a surprise, it's not a secret, but they've done it particularly openly here. Quite often they try and have some kind of veil of secrecy over it, but they've been particularly open here. This is directed from Israel. It's an Israeli government-inspired campaign, and of course the rest of the Zionist movement falls into line.
I also asked Jackie for her thoughts about Christian Wakeford, who called Roger Waters to be deplatformed.
I mean, honestly, I don't even know where to begin with this awful man, because this, again, is very typical of what's happening. You know, you're getting racists calling anti-racists racist. And this person is really dross. That's what he is. When he was a Tory, because he actually crossed over from being a conservative onto Labour, he was saying the most awful anti-immigrant stuff, you know, like refugees come here and they've got sort of a shopping basket of things they want. He was really being unpleasant. And of course, he's just had to apologise. Mind you, his apology was accepted for hobnobbing with a kind of accepted Islamophobe at the Houses of Parliament. And these are the kind of people. But the interesting thing about Chris Wakeford is that he actually said things about Roger Waters that had he not had parliamentary privilege, he would have been sued. And there's a real problem with this. I've had this done against me. They can stand up in Parliament. It will be reported everywhere. And so it will be thought of as being the truth. And because they have protection of speech in Parliament, they can lie and get away with it. I mean, these people are just scum, really.
David, I mean, Roger Waters seems to have swallowed some of the Zionist propaganda about Iran, doesn't he? I mean, what's that all about, do you think?
So one of the things, you saw that in the film, in the show, is that he flashes up the names of people, and you would think from the Israeli government's tweet that it was just Shireen Abu Akleh and Anne Frank. But no, there's lots of names he flashes up, and these are names of people, according to Roger Waters himself, who've been killed by the state. He talked about traveling through and touring in the US, and every time he went to a new city, they would put up the names of people, almost all black people, who'd been killed by the police. Mm-hmm. And so this is about directly focusing on state killings. Yes. Now, one of the names that's up there is Mahsa Amini, who was, of course, died in Iran and was said by anti-Iranian government protesters to have been beaten up by the police and killed by the state. No such thing happened. She collapsed, as the video footage showed. She wasn't killed by the state. So that's an indication of the kind of the factual basis of her name being included being problematic. And of course, what Waters then did was he tweeted about he tweeted, "Hey Ayatollah, leave those kids alone." I mean, to use the term Ayatollah, questionable, but he'd obviously been lobbied, and he said this at one of his concerts in Los Angeles. People had held up this sign with her name on it, and he'd fallen into the idea that this was a popular uprising as opposed to something developed by the CIA and indeed by Mossad. Well, it's unusual for him to do that because, of course, he was quite perceptive on the whole question of Syria and called out the White Helmets as being a proxy for NATO. So it's kind of it's an interesting thing where he probably was misled.
Do we have any clues as to who might have kind of lobbied Roger Waters?
Well, we already know. He said there was people who were supporters of the protests, i.e. Pro-Avists and supporters of the dictatorship, the Shah, who came to his concert and held up the sign. They gave him the sign later. So we know that, that there was that kind of contact. So presumably that was part of the process.
Yeah, sure. Well, I then asked Jackie whether she thought the campaign against Roger Waters will succeed, or if she felt that he had sufficient resources, and indeed public goodwill for that matter, to prevail against the smears.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I think it's actually not quite worked for them, this. What it has done, you've got three sets of people. You've got the kind of people who will believe this nonsense anyway. And then I asked my son, who's actually a DJ, so he's in the music business, and he said, well, most people, most young people, aren't talking about this at all. And those of them who are just going even more, what is this going on? And what are they trying to do by stopping us listening to our music?
Well, we'll continue the discussion in a moment, because we've got another report now about the attempts by Zionists to disrupt and subvert Roger Waters' efforts to secure justice for Palestine.
As Roger Waters found himself embroiled in a confected crisis over false allegations from Zionist smear factories, a group of Israeli activists on a mission snuck into his London show. As he launched into his anti-fascist sequence from Pink Floyd's album, The Wall, the group unfurled an Israeli flag to launch a stunt. They were promptly ejected from the arena by security. The mainstream media in England launched into its usual hysterics, claiming the daughter of a Holocaust survivor had been manhandled at the Waters show. But who was the woman in question? Yochi Davis is a Trump-supporting member of the Board of Deputies and also a former employee of the Israeli Occupation Forces propaganda group, My Truth. Her work for the Zionist military was so popular that the Likud Minister of Justice, Amir Ohan, personally sent her a video of thanks. The campaign against Waters is complex. It's also been noted that he was taken in by the anti-Iran propaganda during the US and Israeli-backed riots. Waters' support for Palestine cannot be questioned. But how can Palestinians resist if the only state that materially supports that right is to be attacked in such a way? Palestine Declassified can reveal that a current high-ranking employee of Israeli intelligence front Zodiac Maritime, which has been a key part of the war against Iran, was previously employed by Waters. Annabelle Hazel was employed by Roger Waters UK Limited through his manager Mark Fenwick. She's presently executive assistant to Daniel Offer, CEO of Zodiac Maritime, which was revealed by the Sunday Times to be an Israeli intelligence front attempting to smuggle agents into the Islamic Republic of Iran. It seems logical to wonder if she was spying on Roger Waters whilst working for him. What other nefarious means is Israel using to divert his calls for justice in Palestine?
David, tell us about this Yochi Davis and this My Truth organisation that she's involved with.
So it's an organisation set up and staffed by ex-IDF people or reservists in the IDF, and it's there to speak the truth of the occupation forces, their truth about how they're not nearly as brutal as is being suggested by the world's media. And Davis is part of that organisation. As the film says, she's been, you know, personally thanked by Zionist regime ministers. And the organisation that she was there with was also another Zionist organisation. These are all of these organisations, they look like they're ordinary Jews protesting against anti-Semitism. But, you know, time and time again we find these are actually organisations which are directed from and have links directly with the Israeli government. So this is an indication of how Zionism operates. They try and pretend these are ordinary Jews protesting against what they would call racism, against anti-Semitism, but almost always where it doesn't exist. And then yet we find, when we look a little bit deeper, we scratch a little bit beyond the surface, that these are actually active Zionist agents.
Mm. Well, I asked Jackie about the media spin on that failed attempt to unfurl an Israeli flag at a Roger Waters concert.
Yeah, I mean, that was extraordinary, wasn't it? One thing I just love about it as well is that they always choose photos for these people that show them really sweet and nice. I mean, this person went there with all intention to actually disrupt the show. You know, it wasn't her intention to go there and make a statement. They had been out there protesting before. They had been abusing people. They had been trying to actually agitate people so that they would be attacked. Again, this is what they do. What they want is to agitate people who are not so knowledgeable, perhaps, as some of us, who will then get angry, and then they'll take photos of them, and they'll take videos of them, and then they'll use that. And that's what this woman was doing. And she was asked politely not to do it. She became aggressive. All these people, it's the same technique over and over again. She is part of a planned campaign of disinformation. That's what she is.
David, I believe the organisation responsible for the demonstration outside his show was the National Jewish Assembly. I mean, who are they and who's behind them?
oh, it's a fantastically named organisation, isn't it? It sounds like it's a kind of nationwide organisation representing the Jews, a communal organisation. But of course it's not. It's a rival to the Board of Deputies. And the reason it's a rival to the Board of Deputies is it was set up by a guy called Gary Mond. Now, Gary Mond was on the Board of Deputies and also on the Jewish National Fund, one of the four Israeli national institutions which is involved in ethnic cleansing in Palestine. And he was forced to resign from these organizations because of his comments about Islam. He talked about being at war with Islam. He had retweeted and liked tweets by Pamela Geller, the well-known Islamophobe who's banned from this country for being such a racist. Mm-hmm. And he was forced out of those organizations. And he set up this new organization to be a rival to the Board of Deputies. It's bankrolled by him himself. And so this is a kind of a far-right rival to the Board of Deputies, pretending to be a Jewish communal organization, which is so pro-Israel that they are deeply, deeply into Islamophobia.
Mm. And tell us about the Zodiac Maritime and the relevance of Annabel Hazel, who I think went to work for them, didn't she?
So Zodiac Maritime, as the film suggested there, was revealed by the Sunday Times to be a front for the Mossad. It's run by the Offer family, one of the richest families, I think the richest family in Israel. Sami Offer was the patriarch, now dead, who gave his name to a school at the Herzliya University in occupied Palestine, the only private university which reserves places for elite military and intelligence operatives as students. And this is a company which is used by Mossad to take agents into Iran. And of course, we know that Mossad's been engaged in the campaign of assassination of nuclear scientists in Iran. When I was there, I saw the cars of some of the people who had been killed, executed, bombed by Mossad. And so that was the process that was being used there. She now works as an assistant to the CEO. That's one of Sami Afra's sons, Daniel. And one can only imagine what on earth she was doing in Waters' office. Perhaps it was entirely innocent. But now, what will she be able to tell Zodiac Maritime and therefore almost directly the Mossad about Roger Waters? Now, there's an indication of the way in which Israeli spying is deeply, deeply involved in a whole range of places. Zodiac Maritime's a company, but nevertheless, it's being used by the Mossad, and as are many people, clearly, to spy on the pro-Palestine movement.
Right. Well, I also asked Jackie if any of this surprised her.
I mean, these are the same people. And there's, you know, they're all working together. However, you know, many of them, and look, it's the same on the left. Many of us on the left, we're members of different organisations. And it's so with these people as well, of course. I mean, the difference is where these people can get to and who has their ears. So none of this surprises me. I mean, wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it just be wonderful if we had actually full disclosure when we see MPs and media head people and people speaking from the so-called Jewish community groups who are actually, of course, Zionist community groups? Wouldn't it be great if we had full disclosure about who these people were? Well, I think one thing we know because of the way they behave is that once they have decided to go for you, they won't stop. Now, I suppose to counter that, Roger is both very well connected and very wealthy and very popular. But that doesn't mean he doesn't need our support. He does. He needs our support on there, on social media, countering the lies. He needs our support to actually keep being able to say what he's saying. So I don't expect that their campaign will stop. They see any defeat as just a sign to go in even harder. Because one thing these people cannot take is any challenge to what they say. So we will see this challenge coming up again.
David, why do you think Roger Waters' position on Iran was so wrong? I know you kind of touched on this previously, but just say a little bit more about that.
Well, I mean, I think that he's been misbriefed. Mm. And probably, to be charitable about it, it's an area where he needs more education than he has had. He may have been misled by people who've come to his concert, who've lobbied him to take the line that he took. But clearly what happened in Iran, as we now all know, is that there was an attempt, because the nuclear deal wasn't going well for the US, there was an attempt to provoke unrest as part of the US's hybrid warfare strategy. And of course, as we know, Mossad are also involved to undermine the Islamic Republic. And of course, there's a whole series of people and organizations who are engaged in subversion of Iran. Most of them are funded by, for example, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is, of course, known as the CIA's sidekick, and also some of them funded by the Saudis, the Iran International, for example, the TV channel, funded by the Saudis. And that's one of the organizations that Roger Waters gave an interview to back in September last year, which really is, you know, on the face of it and in retrospect, probably a mistake.
Yeah. Interestingly, I mean, Double Down News, as you know, did an interview with Roger Waters, and that created a huge furore. But they then follow that up with another video showing that there is a tribute band to Roger Waters performing exactly the same concert in Israel. I mean, that kind of sort of exposes, doesn't it, the hypocrisy going on.
It was a famous moment, wasn't there, when Jeremy Corbyn was accused of being a racist for saying that Zionists didn't understand irony. Well, you know, evidently they don't understand satire either. Here was Waters and indeed the Israeli tribute band acting out as Nazis as a satire, which is anti-fascist and anti-Nazi. As everybody who's ever seen it knows, nobody previously has made this mistake and thought, oh, he's actually a Nazi. This is just a concoction which is based not on the Zionists' inability to understand satire, but on the fact that the Zionists lie and repeatedly lie as part of their project to squash all possible opposition to
their policies. I mean, and yet, as we've already said, I mean, you know, you have politicians and the media actually swallowing, or do they? Are they swallowing it, or are they just part of this whole?
Some swallow it, some are ideologically directed, but of course the other thing is fear. People don't want to raise their heads above the parapet. They can see the damage it will do if they do stand on principle. Yeah. And so people they feel they're not knowledgeable enough, so they feel that they should keep their voice quiet.
Well, there's one thing about Palestine Declassified is we're not fearful and we will tell the truth.
We will.
Come hell or high water. Anyway, I'm afraid that we've run out of time today. So let me thank our guest, Jackie Walker, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next time, when I'll be back with more investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
لبيك اللهم لبيك لبيك لا شريك لك لبيك إن الحمد والنعمة لك والملك لا شريك لك لا شريك لك لبيك.
Hajj Pilgrimage, a wonderful opportunity to serve God. Welcome to the fourth programme in our series, Hajj Pilgrimage, a wonderful opportunity to serve God. In this programme, we discuss the Hajj Pilgrimage's role and potential for uniting the Muslim community worldwide, and the great blessings of such Muslim unity. Please stay with us for more. Unity is a key element of the Hajj pilgrimage, which is repeated every year and for which millions of Muslims gather from all over the world. They represent the Muslim Ummah, with all of its different races, countries, colours and languages. They gather in one place, at the same time, wearing the same garments and performing the same rites and rituals. They make one stand in the same monument. They proclaim the oneness of the Lord of the worlds, submit themselves to His law, and show their unity under His banner. They announce to the whole world that they are one nation, although they come from different countries and homes. They perform the rites and stand in the open areas of Mecca, where bodies become close to each other. Faces meet, hands shake, greetings are exchanged, tongues communicate, and hearts reconcile. They meet for the same purpose and the same intention. What unity is deeper than that of the pilgrims when they stand at the mountain of Arafat with bare heads and simple white clothes? There is no difference between the rich and the poor. There is no difference between the ruler and the subject, between men and women. All of them are the same. They direct themselves towards Allah with humility and humbleness. This is their description when they make tawaf, or circumambulation around the Kaaba, the house of God, and sa'y, going between the mountains of Safa and Marwa, stay overnight at Muzdalifah and Mina, sacrifice animals, and throw stones. Similarly, this is their description when they perform the congregational prayer at the open areas or at the holy mosque. They pray behind one man, that is the Imam, and supplicate to one God, Allah. They read the one book, the Holy Quran, and direct themselves to one Qibla, the Kaaba, at the Holy Mosque. They perform the same rites and rituals of standing.